Laws are great when we have good people in office and passing just laws, but they're just that. They are kind of like a stoplight, right? Stoplight, most people will stop at, and they will obey the rules of the road. But that light isn't stopping anyone from running it. And so that's the way I kind of see laws. In the simplest way to break down a law is a stoplight. Stop most people and convince most people, but there's no actually weight behind it. Unless there's a cop there and then you get pulled over, you know, and there's repercussions. And that's how laws are. If you break a law and you figure out a way to get away with it, most people will just keep doing it if they don't have a moral compass. Finding people who share a similar value and, you know, build from there. And it's a long road ahead, but that's the only way I see lasting, impactful change that our kids, our grandkids, and so forth will thank us for.
If I could add one thing on top of that is teach your kids to have difficult conversations. None of this, we don't talk about religion or politics, like teach them how to have conversations about difficult things. I think a lot of the problems we have today are because people have never had or taught to have difficult conversations with one another. It's okay to navigate difficult things like religion and politics. That's what I would add on to that is teach your children to have difficult conversations respectfully with people. And I think you'll find that a lot more things improve too, doing something like that.
How's it going, brother?
Good to see you. Long time no see.
I know, right? I remember when we closed out that episode last time, we were like, yeah, let's do this again soon. It has to be over a year.
Well, then I did the guest host.
You did the guest host. That was last fall or summer, maybe? I don't remember.
Yeah, I think that was like in the summer. Yeah.
Just a you episode, though, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. That was.
It's been over a year.
Yeah, it's been over a year. That was the fall of last year, was the just me. And then, or fall of 2 years ago.
23. Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
And that's funny, too, because that coincidentally was with Chris also, but he wasn't the co-host yet. He just was like sitting in for Zach.
Mm. That's right.
So he was just, because Zach, I don't remember what Zach had going on, but he couldn't be there that night. And so I invited Chris to do that. So it's just kind of funny because he wasn't even like the real co-host yet. He just kind of sat in for it a little preemptive, but he can't be here tonight either. So it's just us. And then you haven't met TJ. This is TJ.
Nice to meet you,
George. So yeah, I am the producer and co-host, of course, now. So
awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, man.
Fun stuff there.
Absolutely.
TJ is the Pugnisher.
That's right.
He is. Yeah. His last name is Castle. No, he used to be a bounty hunter. Don't let him downsell it, too. He is White Django. Yeah.
White Django.
That's right. White Django, gay for pay connoisseur. That's what it says.
What a title.
I know. Yeah, dude, that's his full beauty, title, actually.
It's the beauty when the one hosting the session can change your name.
Right. Yeah. That's his full Christian name right there. Yeah. White Django. It's not biblical, but, you know. Christened. That's what it is.
Right.
Dude, so it's classic. So TJ was a bounty hunter, actually. He's going to downplay it right now. And I say that. So he's like Boba Fett, like for real, but not in space, you know, just in Texas, which is probably awesome. Just as weird as space.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably got plenty of aliens, too. No pun intended.
No, no freaking question about that.
Gang members.
I had to go across the border a few times for some of the things that we were doing. So,
oh, damn.
It was interesting. But we did a lot. We worked through the narcotic channels as liaisons with law enforcement quite often to be able to sort of do things that overreached what they could do at the time without warrants.
Yeah. So kind of that gray area where you're like, oh, they kind of give you
if somebody is in a bond situation and you've kind of been hired for it, then you can step around that a little bit and sort of expose the fact they're moving some chemicals to manufacture methamphetamine at the same time that you're looking for one specific individual.
Nice. Yeah, that's convenient.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun job.
Loopholes. Oh, dude. It was my de-stress, man. I've actually missed it quite a bit, as weird as that is. It really was beating
the shit out of fucking people all the time, you know, just...
Yeah, it's been almost 17 years now, so yeah.
Oh, wow.
Crazy. It's, since you last did it, or since you... Yep. Wow, that's a long time, man. It
what is. Does TJ... Yeah. What's TJ short for? My son's name is TJ as well. He's Timothy James.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, no, mine is actually not biblical. Mine was all from Ireland. So mine is actually Thane and the middle is Joseph. Well, I guess that's biblical.
Oh, yeah.
But, Thane, that was my grandfather, though, is why I was named after my grandfather in that sense. But Thane is an Irish name, and of course, Castle is an Irish surname, and I was O'Sullivan on my father's side, but my dad left 3 months before I was born, so I never knew any of his family.
Gotcha.
So I'm Irish from both.
Now that Rosie O'Donnell has gone to Ireland, you probably won't ever go back to your roots, huh?
The whole entire island will be sunk before I get the chance, I'm sure.
It's true. It's going to capsize. Right.
Either that or
but,
just
you know, I have never seen Rosie O'Donnell and TJ in the same room, just saying.
Oh.
You know, maybe they're one of the same.
They might be.
I don't know. It might be
a good rumor to start.
Justice that's Manley, awesome. Right? That's what I'm saying, dude. Never seen him in the same room. Can't you can't not prove it, right?
Right. Yeah. You can't not prove it.
So that's good enough for me, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
bro,
man,
so much
awesome.
Has happened since the last time we talked. Even so much has happened since we had you on to talk to Dr. Johnston, which is a good conversation. She's super smart. But a lot has happened, man. And a lot of the problems that we were talking about, I remember on that first episode we did, are a lot of the problems that became reasons why Donald Trump won the presidency, I think, right? And then you've got a lot going on. You have some news, I guess, really, you could put it that way, to talk about, because a lot of people will recognize the – can I just say it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, so – George wrote a book that is it was under a pseudonym, Hill Worth Dying On, and this is him, right? This is the guy who wrote that book, and now he's going to come out with another part of it. Is it it's like a rewrite, or is it a...
Yeah, so when I first wrote it, it was self-published, kind of was just a lot of thoughts that I had in my mind, and was like, hey, putting it out there, was slowly putting it together, and then was able to self-publish it through Amazon, which was really awesome experience, kind of learned a lot with that.
Sure.
But thankfully I've been able to get a publisher, and so we're working together, and the biggest thing was the first volume was about 50 pages or so mm-hmm. not even a book, it's more of a booklet, and what the publisher was saying was, you know, they liked what it has, kind of the meat right there, but they want to add more, you know, for to use an analogy, you know, I got the meat of the meal, but we got to add some side dishes to it, you know, we got to add to it and make it presentable in that sense. So that's what I've been working on now. Been working on a handful of other stuff too, though, as you know, I've been back and forth telling you, you know, applying to law school.
Right.
Worked on the Kennedy campaign when RFK was running for president. So yeah, I've been bouncing around and just staying busy as best I can. Plus, you know, TJ's been keeping me plenty busy, just, you know, being a dad. He's one and a half now, so he's finding everything, all the trouble he can find. That's my full-time job when I'm with him.
That's what I always tell everybody when they complain about having a baby. It's like, at least it's not mobile yet.
Yeah. Right?
Just wait till it can run, like, I keep saying it, but wait till your baby can run around. Then you have to, like, watch it like a hawk, right? It's so different.
He's a client.
That's when the fun really begins.
Over time too. Everybody always tries to say, like, I remember Steven Crowder, to kind of throw a familiar name out there. He's got twins, and he was talking about how people will try to say, I'll just wait till they get older. And he's always like, nothing can be worse than when they're babies and they're whining and they're crying and you don't know what they need. That is the easiest time to take care of a child by far. Yeah. And I'm kind of in a unique situation with that. My wife had a long series of medical problems that have gone on throughout our relationship. So I actually raised all three of our kids almost entirely on my own. And so I changed, you know, all the diapers, dealt with all the middle of the night stuff and everything else. So I can say, honestly, that situation you are in control of. Now they're 9, 11, and 12.
Yeah.
Well,
dude, I had a buddy one time, like he just had his kid. And he was complaining about, like, how hard it is. And I was like, yeah, you know, it's total change. Like, the sleep deprivation thing is, like, super hard on people. But I was like, but you just took your infant out on a date. I was like, wait till you have a two-year-old. Then try going on a date. Right?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. It's not a date anymore. It's your baby sitting at a table in a restaurant now. Like, that's what's going on. Like, you're trying to keep, like, your kid from throwing their mac and cheese. Yeah, their Kraft mac that the restaurant made for you, right? On the floor. That's what you're trying to prevent from happening. That's now your date. But it's kind of funny.
It's night and day. I know. He's at that stage now. Like, we went out to dinner, like, last weekend, and it was the same thing. You know, every 10 minutes or so, we got to look over and be like, hey, do we have to take you outside? You know, are we calling it? You know, he kind of trained him, like, hey, if you're acting up, we stand outside with you, you know, for – 5 minutes or whatever, and he just looks and he's like, no, I'm good. I'm good. And then, you know, that holds him back for 5-10 minutes, and then it's again. But
that's good.
Yeah. I miss the days where we'd put him in the stroller next to the table. He sleeps for the whole dinner, and then then you head home.
Yeah. You look at each other like, this is easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally easy. You know, that's okay. You know, it's kind of funny. Now, then they get a personality. And I always tell people like people think 2 is bad, but like 3 is definitely worse because now they have more of a personality and they can be conniving. Like they can think ahead and plot certain things out, right? Like whereas like 2 is just like full id, you know, you're just getting the full weight of toddler angst. But then when they become a 3-nager, then they're like planning things. Like, and they can like weigh their decisions. So like, you know what? What is going to get me the most bang for my buck? Yes, yeah. I will drop mom's phone and her coffee. That'll do it. That'll do it. Yeah, absolutely. It's premeditated all the time, dude. Premeditated toddlers. That's what you call them, man.
For real. Well, mine are now at the age where they kind of do what they want to do for the most part. And, you know, they've developed their own opinions, attitudes, dispositions.
Well, you've got preteens, man.
Oh yeah. Well, and the funny thing is my oldest is, you know, my oldest son, he's actually the most docile all the way around. Mm-hmm. Like he's, first of all, my father, though I didn't meet him, he was very tall. And my mother was 4'10", so I ended up this weird thing in between. But my wife's father was also, 6-foot-plus. So he is already almost as tall as I am at 12 years old.
Good for him, though.
He is rail freaking thin. His metabolism is ultra fast. He eats all day. He's never not hungry. He eats snacks nonstop, sneaks him in his room constantly at night, and never gains any weight at all. But,
wild.
You know, he says he makes video games. He does digital animation. He does hand-drawn animation. He's getting into retro animation. Plays a euphonium this year, first year in middle school. So
that's cool.
He's always real casual and reserved. Anything I ask him to do or anything I say to him, he takes it very seriously, and he's real earnest in that sense. My daughter, the 11-year-old.
Oh, not the same. Remind you of your bounty hunting days?
Oh, there's so many times that people, before I ever had kids, when I was just working as a technological engineer all the time, I'd have clients that had, you know, children that went up through college. And they'd always say, if you ever have kids, I want to forewarn you, if you have daughters, you're going to love them in the beginning. And they're usually very close to their dads. And by the time they get to that teenage realm, you'll wish you could switch them out for sons from about 12 years old all the way up till about 25.
Dang.
And I used to always think, everybody's got a little thing to complain about. Now they're dead on right. My daughter's going through puberty early. She's a freaking nightmare.
Dude, like, I've heard that like girls are easier up front and harder later, and boys are harder up front and easier later.
Yeah, and it's just the rambunctiousness and kind of craziness with boy toddlers and kind of coming up into that age. They like to wreck stuff.
I know. Well,
it's kind of funny.
We nicknamed our son Captain Chaos because as soon as, you know, he's like starting to walk now. Any surface, he's a climber, so we're like,
yeah,
he's at that stage as soon as he started walking and like, you know, the gears are turning, he's like,
right,
all right, where can I go, what chaos can I cause? And then we're just sitting there,
that's awesome.
Like, our friends, all we've got a couple of friends who have daughters about a similar age, and we're like, hey, so like, are you guys, is this a problem? We'll be like, you know, does he try to climb on the counter all the time? Or does your daughter try to climb on the counter? They're like, no, we don't deal with this. We're like, no. Oh, okay, so this is the boy thing. In 10-ish years or so, then we'll be like, oh, this is easy. And they'll be telling us like, oh man, daughters are rough.
Yeah.
Dude, can confirm. Like my daughter was way more chill. My son, it's just, he's a boy, dude.
Yeah.
Like he's a boy's boy. He loves being outside, loves bugs and mud and grass and all that stuff. Like it's just all up in it, you know? And it's kind of funny because it makes me think of that whole thing you hear from like drill instructors at basic training, how like the dudes show up and like they kind of fight for who's going to be the leader, and eventually they come together and it's like a well-oiled machine. But chicks show up and they immediately, it's like all the fake, like, oh, we could do this, and like gradually fall apart because, you know, like chicks are naturally catty, you know? So it's kind of funny, like easier up front, harder on the back end.
I can tell you right now, brother, at 11 years old, the things I hear my daughter and her friends say to each other back and forth is insane. They hate each other on a like 2 to 3 day basis. Like she'll be friends with these three girls, and then two of those three girls hate each other, and then it's her, the other girl, and some other new girl who are all now a pack, and nonstop in a constant rotation. Like, oh, I hate Alyssa. I'm never going to talk to her again. And then 2 days later, she's like, oh, I hate Roslyn. I'm talking to Alyssa, and I'm like, Didn't you just? Never mind.
Yeah, that's it, man. That's it.
There is none of that true friendship, that loyalty, that brotherhood like guys get to where you've had that set of friends that are your true friends. Girls don't have that jazz, man. It's like they're all just waiting to snipe each other for no reason.
Oh, it's like boys. I remember, you know, you're in grade school. You get in a fight with a kid. You know, someone gets a busted nose, someone gets a black eye, and then you come home and you're like, oh yeah, no, it's all good. Like, oh, are you mad at so and so? Like, no, we're all good. Friends, we're friends now. I'm actually going to his house. So I'm going over to his house after dinner or on the weekend. It's just done is done.
That's the truth.
It's true. It's like that's it, man. That's like every male relationship exists with the threat of violence at any point. You know what I mean? And when you figure it out, right, it just like doesn't exist. I mean, it's always there, but like that's what kind of keeps the thing going. You know what I mean? Like, this is always like, tell me you don't walk through a restaurant or like a store and just size up everybody. Like, yeah, I could take that person. Like, no, nah, probably not. That dude's yoked. You know what I mean? He would kill me. You know, like, I can't be the only one. I know I'm not the only one.
No. Well, and of course, I mean, with your background, with my background, with your background as well, George, that's a normal thing we all do anyway by training, is just, you know, checking exits, looking at who's in the room, watching for suspicious activity, seeing people who seem out of place, people's eye movement. But it's a dude thing for sure to size everybody up.
Oh yeah, right. That's how you make some of the best friends. I was gonna say, one of my closest friends beat the hell out of me when I was in grade school. Just slammed me on the ground, pinned me, and then I stood up and he was like, "Are we good? Are we good now?" I'm like, "Yeah, I deserve that. That was my bad."
Right.
You know, we still joke about it now. I'm like, oh, you know, water under the bridge.
Yeah.
That's exactly how my best friend and I met, except it was the other way around. I whooped him for picking on somebody else, and he started making fun of weird pictures on the walls and asking the principal all these kind of intrusive questions while we were waiting in the office. And the principal got frustrated, forgot why we were in there, and he just sent us back to class, and we were friends from that moment forward.
Dude, that's hilarious.
Neither one of us got in trouble.
Just trolled the principal.
Yeah, he was looking at pictures on the wall. He's like, is that your wife? She looks a lot younger than you, sir. And stuff like that.
Just, oh my gosh.
Oh yeah, man.
Is she a good cook?
He's a slick guy. He still is to this day. But he's extremely antisocial. He hates people. So he lives in the woods out in the middle of nowhere. Like he's got an outhouse for a bathroom that's like 30 yards from his house.
Right? Oh, that's real out there then. You've got an outhouse. Yeah.
For real.
Mm-hmm. He's the dude I told you about that lives on Orcas Island outside Washington.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
He sits out there, dude. Cuts down trees at like resorts and Airbnbs and stuff, the real big ones. An arborist. And goes back to his cabin in the woods, man.
Nice. Not much, but it's honest work.
That's right.
Yeah. Dude, so I've been wanting to ask you for a while, but like, what was it like working for the RFK campaign? But then more importantly, like, why, other than experience, right? Why did you choose to work for the RFK campaign?
So I think it'd be easier to probably answer the first one and then go on to the experience. So I chose it because I genuinely believed he was the best candidate at the time. I loved his messaging. You know, we've talked to both on the podcast and in private kind of how, you know, I'm not happy, as a lot of Americans aren't happy with the two-party system. You know, sometimes it feels like you're picking the lesser of two evils, or it's, you know, the two sides of the same coin, you know, plenty of analogies to it. And so I still felt, you know, that I wanted to work for a independent candidate. And Bobby's background was something that really drew me in. You know, he's, you know, worked really heavily with the environment and made really good progress in cases with that. He, you know, cares about the health of Americans rather than, you know, his whole big fight is big against big pharma. So rather than constantly pills and easy solutions, it was, let's get to the root cause of a problem. And, you know, with we've talked about too, with foreign engagements, you know, he was really much in the sense of, there's a time and a place to get involved with foreign conflict, but we shouldn't be necessarily sticking our nose into every issue. So there was a lot of issues that I really agreed with and drew me in. And so the way I got the job was I reached out to the campaign. I saw that there was they were looking for some help in Chicago and in Illinois. And next thing I know, I got an email saying, hey, we'd We love your resume. We're interested. Let's do an interview. Interview went really well, and they pretty much said, hey, we've got a position for the state director job, and we think you'd be a great fit. And, you know, rest is history, so to speak. And it was a really awesome experience. You know, I think the most valuable aspect of it for me was, and this is something you won't get in a campaign for if you're either working for the Democrat or the Republican candidate, mm-hmm. is that it was very mixed. I was working with individuals who were saying that they had been, lifelong Republicans or lifelong Democrats. And they just said, enough is enough. For one reason or another, they left that party, and then they came and they were supporting an independent candidate. And so it was really cool to work with these people who, you know, even perhaps in the last election would have been at each other's throats, so to speak. But they put their differences aside and focused on a common goal. And so I mm-hmm. thought that aspect of his campaign truly was a true example of uniting Americans for a common cause. And that aspect was the most inspiring to me.
Mm-hmm. What was the general feeling or the reaction from everybody when he announced that he was going to stop running and was going to sort of join forces with Donald Trump?
I think, you know, obviously the initial reaction was not disappointment, but sadness in that sense, because mm-hmm. it was something that we truly believed in. We truly felt we had a dog in the fight. Or a horse in the race, you know, and
with the analogies.
You know, we were working for a really, really a good cause. At the same time, you know, a lot of us, we would look at the aspect of it from a like realistic political aspect. And, mm-hmm. I completely respect and understand his decision on why he did what he did. Because now he is, even though he's, you know, not president. Now he's in a position yeah. where he's in the administration and he is working, and he has, you know, he has more say than most people in America right now, and more influence Certainly. Than he ever has had to really do the things that he has been championing his whole life. So I completely respect and understand why he did what he did. And it's awesome to see that he's where he is now. And, you know, I'm very hopeful that, he can implement a lot of the he's working for. So,
yeah, man, I'm going to assume your experience running for state office probably made you a pretty prime candidate, huh?
It did help. Yeah. It helped in the sense that, I knew a lot of, the area of Chicago, for sure. I had mm-hmm. some experience within the state. And so, you know, that was good. On the flip side, there were aspects where I couldn't really use, many of the connections that I had because I'd ran as a Republican. So, mm-hmm. Most of kind my like connections from the Republican Party were working for, or assisting yeah. the Trump campaign. But the experience in itself, the raw experience definitely helped.
Yeah.
It's as simple as knocking on doors, organizing events, coordinating. And this was interesting because it was at a state level. So I was mm-hmm. coordinating with people all the way, from the northernmost part of Illinois to Chicago to central or east Illinois, all the way down to southern Illinois. And, I was driving around, going to state fairs, going to county fairs, stuff like that. And so that was a cool experience. In a sense, it was a little kind of preview of how it works for people who are running for, larger state or national mm-hmm. campaigns. It was pretty cool to get that experience and be a part of something that I truly believed in.
Yeah. I'd imagine it's probably much easier to campaign for Robert Kennedy in Illinois than it would have been to campaign for Donald Trump.
It was interesting.
Especially in Chicago.
Yeah. I initially thought that, it was interesting though, it was kind of split. So in outside of Chicago, it was pretty good. Mm-hmm. It was actually interesting. Was more Republicans were welcome. They were welcoming to kind of our pitch or to Bobby's campaign. The most resistance we found was actually in places like Chicago, where it's a heavy Democrat stronghold. Yeah. We'd be walking on the door and people would be, saying, oh no, we're all for Harris. We're all in for Harris. I'm like, she dropped out 2 days ago. Like, how are you, or she just, or Biden dropped out 2 days ago. That was the funny part. I was like, okay, you know, your party first. Fair enough.
No matter who. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and when you're working on a campaign, whether it's your campaign or someone else's, you've just got to say, thanks for your time. Have a nice day and go on to the next one. Right. But yeah, it was interesting was the Republicans were much more welcoming and friendly, even if at the end of it they said, no, we're not going to vote, we're going for Trump. Mm-hmm. They would at least entertain a conversation. So, you know, that was a good experience. But there were a good amount of people who, you know, were kind of on the fence, you know, even especially when Biden dropped out. There were mm-hmm. a good amount of people who were kind of Democrats, but they saw, hey, you know, I feel like this switch, they kind of put them on the wrong foot. The switch straight to Harris. So
it's a bait and switch.
Yeah. So some people were a lot more welcoming. There were people also Republicans who, you know, not to say they were never Trumpers, but they were, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they were supporting in his first time or whatever reason, but they were hesitant about Trump this time. Mm-hmm. And they enjoyed the opportunity of just even contemplating another option. Yeah. I don't know how they voted, obviously.
Sure.
But it was interesting that a lot of people, there's still that little bit when you tell someone, hey, you've got another option.
Right.
It makes them think. And a lot of people like having another option. So,
yeah. I think the thing you said just now was really interesting, that Republicans, people who were registered Republicans that you talked to, were much easier to discuss a third party candidate with than Democrats. And I think that it's pretty indicative of how a lot of people interpret the sort of political spectrum now, you know, just the way what Republicans seem to represent, like more the America First Republicans, I think, seem to represent versus like the modern American left represents. Right. And also, too, it's pretty indicative of it as well. When you look at the people that Trump has around him now, people like Bobby, right? He opened that tent up way more representation of political views, you know, and sort of taking the things like with Bobby, like I've never agreed with him on his stance on, you know, the Second Amendment, right? Like personally, but he's not in a area where he can have an influence in that. I mean, he's still being used, and it paints a really good picture of how earlier you made mention of setting differences aside to have conversations. It's like, it's such a good representation of how differences can be set aside at the highest level. When you look at the people that now work with Donald Trump, his cabinet, even like Tulsi is a good example of this, you know, just kind of how her political views have shifted over time and the things that she sort of represents. But the tent of people that exist up underneath that are a much broader set of ideas. It's more that, you know, John Stuart Mill marketplace of ideas than really anything that the left had to offer last campaign, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that that idea of, you know, I guess the kind of, you know, an analogy would be, you know, if your wife and you are in the middle of an argument, right, at home, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden the fire alarms start going off and the house is burning down.
Never happened.
You're not going to continue that fight. You're going to start saying, hey, let's focus on the house is on fire. Let's put the fire out, and then we can get back to the discussion at hand. And so I think, you know, a lot of people realize, especially around the Making America Healthy Again. Mm-hmm. I think I see that as the issue. And I think a lot of people saw that as like the pressing issue. Mm-hmm. We're not a healthy country. If our children aren't growing up healthy, then I mean, that's the future. So everything else kind of falls to the wayside. And, you know, that's not to say that other issues aren't important. But I think it was a good rallying cry for people to kind of say, hey, let's wake up, let's focus on this, and we can argue about other things, but at the same time, you know, we can be allies. Just in the same analogy, kind of like, you know, you guys with your wives, you guys don't agree, I'm sure, me with my wife, you know, we don't agree on everything, but you know,
that's any two people.
Yeah, you're never going to be 100% in agreement about anything with or about with anyone. So, you know, but you can still make it work. You can still respect other opinions and decisions and, work for, you know, the common good and the common goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. What do you think that, at least like what Bobby's campaign promises and things that he was running for, what do you think he's going to have the most opportunity to take care of that he wanted to do and sort of his presidential campaign promises now that he's Health and Human Services?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is the overall, you know, make America healthy again, that the MAHA movement. I think the biggest thing is he can really, I obviously I can't speak for him, but my biggest hope is that he gets to the root causes of why there's so much chronic illness. Do I think that these issues are going to be solved in 4 years? No. But do I think that in 4 years, if he is allowed to do what he wants to do, do I think that we can get to the root causes of at least a handful of them, and then move forward from there? I definitely think that, and that's my hope, is that that we can at least get answers to why are we facing these problems. And then once we have the answers, then it would be up to the next administration and so forth to take the appropriate steps.
Yeah. I mean, if things go well for him, let's just say, like, fingers crossed, maybe somebody like J.D. Vance is able to run and win in 2028. I feel like, you know, if the work that Bobby does over the next 4 years is good, you know, it would be a good idea to keep him on, right? Just like to kind of continuity of that body of work to keep it going. But, dude, going after Big Pharma is going to be such a daunting task. Like, that is one of those things that we all talk about, like, the deep state, and we're talking about, like, the intelligence complex, military industrial complex, all these things that are so overt. And, you know, Big Pharma, especially over the last 4 years, has definitely gotten a lot more attention. But that is such a different way. You have to go a different approach to handle and take care of something like that. Now you're talking about the rottiest rot of capitalism is what you're dealing with. It's not, I mean, like, obviously that all exists inside the military industrial complex and some of these other things, but that's it. Like, it is private sector through and through for the most part, you know. Like, that is going to be such a different animal. And that concerns me more than anything, to see how that's going to happen, because this, you're talking about billions and billions of dollars every year that goes into that. Yeah. And you, when the person is the customer and keeping them unhealthy is how you make your money. Like, that's, it's a hard task. I don't know how he's going to go about that. I mean, there's going to be a lot of litigation for sure.
Seriously valiant battle, though. It's one of the best ones to take on, because it is one of the biggest poisons in our society. It's, you know, it's governing people's lives, and your health is such a crucial thing. People don't realize that until they have something chronic going on and they have to live day by day trying to do something just to get by. It cuts so deeply into your quality of life. And that's what these pharmaceutical companies are relying on, is keeping you in that kind of perpetual state of feeling like you're, you know, just better enough to make it, you know, another day.
You're just on the cusp of feeling fine. If you just need this, that kind of thing, right? Yeah.
I think too is, you know, the difference, you know, you brought up the military industrial complex. I think the big difference too is it's a lot easier for people to look at a, you know, CEO of, say, a, you know, Lockheed Martin or Raytheon and say, oh, this guy's making money because of bombs being dropped on people. I don't like that guy. It's a lot easier to see them as the bad guy. But
no doubt,
people have become kind of, you know, what you guys were saying is, like, people have become very dependent on all these medicines. So they see it as something they need. And it's going to be a lot. It's really tough to convince someone that they don't need this. And it might hurt in the short term, but it's worth it in the long term. And because all they've known is, hey, this prescription is what I need because of, you know, they don't even see their habits as bad. You know, how many people do you know where, whether it be smoking or drinking too much or eating too much fast food, you know, there's plenty of list of bad habits that we all have, and we all have our vices. And, you know, you embrace some of them, absolutely, and you hope that you live a healthy enough lifestyle that it offsets it. But when you try to bring up certain vices with people and you say, hey, have you ever thought of, you know, maybe cutting back on the drinking or cutting back on, you know, the smoking or something like that, or the fast food, whatnot, the reaction they have is, well, no, this is my life. You know, I'm going to make my choices. So I think that when it comes to, and they have the easy out of the pharmaceutical companies to, hey, here's the Band-Aid, here's the pill for this. I think it's going to be a harder fight to convince people, because it requires a change in themselves rather than a change in this far off organization that, you know,
sure,
is affecting countries overseas in conflict, but it's not, I'm still just living at home and not, I don't see it every day. It's not, I'm not part of the issue at hand.
Yeah. There's almost like a loaned trust that you have to give the CEOs of these military industrial complexes. It's like, well, they're influencing foreign policy and that happens over there, to your point. Right. So I trust that they're doing what they're doing to, you know, to keep the enemy in second place, versus, you know, the more insidious way that like big pharma and big food are tied into one another. Like they are all just this big animal, you know, to try to take down. But When you're sitting there talking about like these changes, and it is, people only change if they really want to change. But like the solution is simple. It really is. It's like eat less, exercise more, right? And a lot of these chronic illnesses people have, and like, don't get me wrong, right? Like science and medicine has absolutely come up with some amazing things. You know, I'm not, you know, completely anti-vaccine. Like there are vaccines that have saved people's lives, right? Pasteurization, like all of these things that have come around, like why people live better lives now, you know, purification of water, all these different things. But, you know, these most people on certain pharmaceuticals or a lot of these ailments that they have could be taken care of if they would just eat less, eat healthier, and then exercise more. Like that's really it. But it is, I mean, you know, right? Like even like you were in the military, just like I was, George, like there was still fat kids in the Army, just like there's still fat kids in the Air Force. And it's like, bro, you have all of these resources available to you. You can go see a nutritionist on base or on post. You can go to one of probably several gyms on base at 24 hours and go exercise, right? Like you have mandatory PT, you know? And so even with resources, people still make the wrong decision. And you're right. So like you're asking people to change habits in their life. That's not going to happen for most people. But, you know, so it's like one of these things where you have to figure out a way of getting rid of all of these things and then at the same time convincing people that this is the better way to live, you know. But that and that's tied into a lot of other things, you know, income, you know, where you grew up, how you grew up, all these things, you know. It's just goes back to having a strong family unit with great role models is really all that boils down to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like you said, like, I mean, I love going to the gym, you know, throughout the week, right, and, you know, working out all the time. Like, there are plenty of times where I'd uphill love to battle, just sit on the couch and be like,
yeah,
you know, I, with the kid, I'm like, I go to the gym at like from 8 to like 9:30 at night. And I'm like,
yeah, it's when you have time.
Roll into the gym. I put TJ to bed, you know, and I roll to the gym at like 8 o'clock or so. I'm like, oh, I just want to sit on the couch and, you know, veg out. But, you know, you, like you said, I set an example. I mean, you know, from my experience personally, was my dad passed away when he was 59. I was 23. So, you know, and he passed away because he didn't work out. He was overweight. Mm-hmm. He ate terribly. All preventable aspects that, you know, if he had taken care of himself in the right way, he would be here today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, I see that as, well, I didn't grow up knowing my grandfather. He didn't grow up knowing his grandfather. And my son won't grow up knowing his grandfather. So it's three generations in my family that haven't known their grandfather. Mm-hmm. I'm going to break that cycle.
Yeah.
So, dude, you know, if it means that I'm waking, you know, if it means I'm going to the gym at 8 o'clock and, you know, instead of sitting down on the couch eating bonbons, I think that's a fair sacrifice if it means that, you know, my grandkids will at least know me. So it's, dude, it's breaking that cycle and making it, it's finding that personal aspect that gives you that drive. So that when you say, hey, I don't want to do this, that in the back of your mind, you go, nope, you are doing it. You don't have a choice.
Yeah. Now that hits close to home for me too. My dad's still around, but like, and if he's listening to this, right, it's nothing I've not said to him before, but like, you know, he's a big guy and doesn't take very good care of himself. And I've said that to him. It's like, dude, like, I'm just being real. You're not going to be around for much longer if you continue down this path, you know. And this is somebody that, you know, he was active duty for 23 years, and you have to maintain a relative level of good fitness to remain in the military and pass your physical fitness exams and stuff like that. But like, you know, after joining, this happens to a lot of veterans in general, even people that like retire from their civilian careers, just kind of like stop taking care of themselves, I guess. But like that kind of happened. And I look and I see this and it's like, I don't want that for me. I don't want my son to have this conversation with me
Right.
You know, be like, hey, dude, like, I don't want you to die. I would like you to see my son grow up, right? And be around, right? And you know, just have these conversations. And despite those conversations, and I love you, Dad, but you don't listen, right? You haven't made any changes, you know, to improve your life. And it just sucks because, and I don't want my son to like look at me and A, see a bad example as somebody who doesn't take care of themselves. It doesn't care enough about him to take care of myself. So I'm, you know, doing everything I can to remain around as long as I physically can. Cause like, no, you could work out your whole life and then die at 45 or some, what I mean? So I'm giving myself the best shot by trying to remain healthy, eat healthy, exercise, all these things. Like I'll get up at, you know, at 4:30 and I'm at the gym before work, because by the time I get home, I don't want to have to do anything else but hang out with my family. Right. So like I cut time out of my morning and, you know, it sacrificed some sleep to go and take care of myself because I care about what he sees. I'm his example of manhood and what he's going to encounter and the thing and the way he's going to approach problems when he gets into his adult life, right? Like you are that example. And this is exactly why I do some of these things. And it's working out has so many other benefits, like mentally, like your cognitive behavior and your cognitive way of functioning is better when you work out. The way that I interact with other people is better because I'm not stressing about my health. You know, it's just there's so many different things that this source of, you know, takes care of. But and even then, I would consider too, I'd probably say like your politics. You have a kid who's 18 months old. You said he's a year and a half. I bet your politics have even changed now that you're a father. I mean, am I wrong?
No. I mean, I would say for the most part, still pretty consistent. But there's absolutely things that I didn't even think of. It's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. That's just life. You know, I changed my views on certain things when you get married. I was like, oh,
facts.
Oh, wait, I have a wife now. I've got to think about different things, you know, and now with a kid, it's like, oh, I never thought of that. I got to think about it more and put more effort into it.
Sure.
And, you know, like kind of what you were saying with the example, one thing that I do, it's about once a year, maybe twice a year, what I do is I really reflect on where I am in life and who I am as a person. And I think if 15, 16-year-old me met me now, what would he respond? Would he look at me and say, oh, that guy's a schmuck?
Yeah.
No. If he would, then I've got to fix some things. If he would have met me and he looks at me and he goes, man, that's a cool guy, I want to be like him, and sees me as a potential role model, then I'm on the right track. And now with having a son, I don't have to do the exercise anymore. I just have to think, hey, how is my son going to look at me? And I got to be the best example I can be. And no one's perfect,
right?
But I'm going to do my best, to set that example.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's everything in your life it comes down to, I think about now. And I'll say this too, having both a son and a daughter, right? The way I want to be is also different, basically, considering who I'm looking at myself through, like whatever lens, the way my daughter is viewing me versus the way my son is viewing me. And like the type of person, like I had my daughter first, right? So the changes in me, I know, are different than like now having a son. There's a totally different feeling involved now as being the father of somebody who's going to be a man one day, right? That's a totally different experience. It's a totally different love. It's a totally different thought process, right? That I have. In a lot of ways, I'm very thankful that I have both of those perspectives because I get to see that, you know, and I get to enjoy the different sorts of relationships I have with my daughter versus my son, and just like the way that they've both changed me. But, you know, at the end of the day, that example is still the same. I should be the best version of myself for both of them so that they see the best version of what, you know, I feel like a man should be, that they have as an example of man, a human being, the way I interact with society, all these things. You know, as a parent, that's your role, is to make sure your children are ready for life and your children understand what right looks like, all of these different, like you are the example. And that's, you know, there's no other way to think about that if you want to consider yourself a good parent, that you have to be that example for them, point blank period.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that.
For sure.
So you said that you're adding more meat to the bone to your book. What are you willing to talk about, like what that meat is, or you're adding the potatoes and the green beans? That's what you said, the side dishes.
Yeah. So certain aspects are being fleshed out more. So there are some chapters where I look back and I'm realizing, oh, you know, hey, I could dive in more with this. You know, it's a good start, but you know, I do some more research, you know, historical research of kind of the founding fathers are good examples of politicians who really fought for freedom, kind of what were their stances. So digging more in that aspect, and then also just analyzing certain aspects that I wrote about more and kind of reflecting on it more and trying to really get my opinions that I stated and state them even more clearly, and more detailed, rather than maybe some of them I just glossed over. And with that too, there's completely different aspects of it where, one major thing that I after I'd written it, I realized, oh, you know, this is one part I'd love to work more on is, it really hit me is, there's always a cause going on, right? There's always some cause that everyone is supposed to get behind and care about. And I realized more and more over the past handful of years is I'd hear about one cause or another and be like, I don't care about it. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but we're all fathers here, right? We all work, we have other obligations. You can only truly care about so many things. And when I say truly care, if my mentality is, if I say I care about something, it means I'm going to put work in to advance that cause. If I'm not going to put any work into it, I'm not going to say I care, because I'm not going to lie and just say something at a party because it sounds right, the right thing to say. I'm going to be straight up with you and say, no, I don't have time for that. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I should.
You kind of have to.
But I don't have the time for it. So there are aspects of that I'm really highlighting more and more of saying, like, you know, time is like money. You know, you only have so much of it and you can only invest it in so much. That's a big part that I'm kind of adding to it of how every person, every American should look at different causes. And, you know, between the three of us, it's going to look completely different. There might be things that I say, oh, wow, I really care about this. You should too. And you'd be like, I just don't. I don't have the time. Fair enough. You know, there's certain things that you guys will look at me and be like, wait, you don't care about that? And be like, no, sorry. And realizing that your neighbor, just because they don't care about a cause or they don't feel as passionate as you do about a cause, doesn't make them a bad person. You know, they're still their neighbor, or they're still your neighbor. And so we, you know, kind of with working like with the Kennedy campaign is you come together to work on a collective goal. I think we need to do that more and be honest with ourselves that we only have so much time and effort that we can put into things. Just because someone else isn't doing the same doesn't mean that they're a bad person, doesn't mean that they're a bad neighbor or a bad American. It just means that they have different priorities, and that's okay.
Yeah, what you're talking about is like doing what you can with what you have where you're at, that whole goofy colloquialism, right? And you know, being participative in whatever it is that you have an interest in is what everybody should be doing. You should have something that you do care enough about to do the work. And that's just sort of how this people government that's representative of everybody is supposed to work. And if you're wasting time and energy trying to convince somebody to rally behind whatever, like you said, whatever cause it is, whether it's gun rights or it's, you know, whatever, the homeless problem in your city or whatever is going on, right? And people just don't care. You're wasting time and energy like trying to convince people to participate. You should be just putting that time and energy into solving those problems. And it goes back to, like you said, the community piece and you're talking to your neighbor and having those conversations. Maybe you're having a conversation with one of them and they realize they don't care about this problem that they do recognize as a problem. Let's just keep with like the homeless thing. Like, yep, I recognize, I see there are homeless encampments underneath the overpass right outside of town or whatever, but I don't care enough to put time and effort into that. Like whatever, you can easily judge that and say, that's pretty crappy that you don't care about homeless people, but people don't. They don't have the time because that's a lot of work that goes into maintaining a food pantry, you know, running out supplies and finding places for them to take care of themselves. And maybe they have a drug problem that's tied in all these things because a lot of those things are espoused to one another, you know. But maybe you're waking them up to realizing that there are problems that I have the energy or the desire to tackle. And, you know, if you don't care, and this is like anything, right? If you don't have an interest in it, you're not going to put energy towards it. And it's going to feel like a job. It's going to feel like a struggle to get those things done. So even having those conversations and being able to help people recognize that there are causes they can get behind, maybe to inspire somebody to action, to do something. Like, this is how these things get taken care of in our society, is because you do realize and be self-aware enough to recognize that what you care about is what you should be working on. And that's, I think it's just, it's simple, but it's a powerful message, because there's not enough of that. There's so many distractions that people would rather put time and effort into watching, you know, the Real Housewives of Atlanta, or, you know, they care more about whatever the hell it is they got going on in their lives. That's sort of, you know, that is just a crutch or an addiction, an entertainment addiction, you know, their phone, let's just use their phone, you know? So that's something we say a lot here, talking about community and getting involved, is just, that's the exact sort of way you're supposed to govern yourselves. It keeps the government out of, like, the big government out of your life by taking care of the things that you are passionate enough to take care of, and helping your neighbor either A, taking care of those things, or realizing that their place is taking care of that, or whatever. It's just, you know, communication, community, and then doing the work.
Yeah, I
think you live out in the woods, dude. You don't really have neighbors, but you know, you got some input on this. Feel like you're cuck chairing over there, brother.
Oh, you're talking about me?
Yeah, yeah. You're sitting there all quiet. Look like you're falling asleep.
Oh yeah, no. Oh no, don't have my phone, man. Well, I mean, it's in here, but it's not in my hand. But yeah, no, brother, I do live out in the woods. I do have neighbors, but it's kind of a different relationship in that sense, mm-hmm. man. I feel people who live, like, in tract home communities, for instance, that are, you know, they see each other in that typical passing, going out in the driveway, whatever, pulling out the trash can, they wave. They never really get to know each other. Out here, because a lot of us have land, a lot of us have, you know, livestock-type animals, people's animals get out, they roam onto other people's property. It's a real normal thing. People's dogs get on, they kill people's animals. It's an area where people are free to shoot very openly. We all get to know each other very well, and we get to know each other's skills. We get to know each other's mannerisms, because it's necessary as a community for us out here to be able to do so, predominantly because we are offset from things. So, of course, Bandera, Texas is a tiny town to begin with. It's a very cool town. It's a tourist town. It's got a lot of history, and it's known as the cowboy capital of the world. Throw that out there. Ooh. But I live out in the sticks outside of that. So basically, and that's a different thing for me. When I grew up in the Rockies, I did grow up in the mountains a lot, but I worked in Denver constantly. So I was in a large city center atmosphere. And when I first was going to move to Texas, the last thing I wanted to do in my mind was be isolated, because I thought if I wasn't around all of those easy resources, it was going to be an uncomfortable lifestyle with no family, no friends, or anything in the region. But I fell in love with living like this and having this openness and this freedom, and also the security, especially when things started going down during, like, COVID, and everybody started kind of acting weird and getting desperate. There was a bigger prepper crowd that was moving up. I realized that it was good to get to know the neighbors out here. And I knew that there was somebody who I saw had some radio equipment kind of standing on his property. So I got to know him, found out, you know, I had a couple radios that I thought would be good in a case of emergency, talked to him a little bit, networked with him, found out what channels I should have active out here in case of emergency, where we could get a hold of each other. And he, of course, had already done so, living here longer, knew a bunch of the neighbors, introduced me to a bunch of people, and we all found out what each other's skills were and kind of where we all stood. Mm-hmm. Beauty of it is, almost every single one of us in this whole kind of group out here are all pretty well constitutional conservatives, like-minded. There's one exception to that. There's one guy out here who also came from Colorado that is a water conservation guy that works for the state. And he is, like, the only kind of liberal-ish one who's out here. And he's not he's not a bad guy by any means, but he's definitely not somebody I would just hang out with.
No. Yeah. Dude, all times, man.
But truly, I mean, it is very, very necessary to have kind of that responsibility. And it's difficult, as you were saying, to come up with enough time. If you're going to put your heart into something, if you're going to put the work into something, then it has to be something you're going to take seriously. And that's kind of where my life is in a scramble. I'm sure that was going through your mind for a minute, Brandon. I sleep about 3 to 4 hours a night, and I do so because I have my eggs in so many baskets, because I care about so many different things. So, of course, with the responsibility of taking care of my kids, with everything that's gone on with my wife, I also was the breadwinner for the family. So I had to rearrange my life, work from home. I built my gym here. I built my studio here. And made it to where I could do everything in one place so that I could kind of run the whole entire family from one location. The other things that slip people's minds is I actually do all of the laundry as well. I clean up almost everything. I cook all of the meals. And we have like 30 animals. So I take care of them too. So I get up in the morning. I take my kids out to meet up with the bus at 6 a.m. And I immediately come back and I start feeding all the rest of the living beings. Exactly. And I love that. And that's how I start my morning every morning before I work, is I take care of everything that needs to be taken care of there. And the nice part working from home, unless I've got to go out in the field for something, is I can just pop in my office. And a lot of times I'll do some work on people's systems. I'll check somebody's network out that they say they thought they saw some irregularities on. Run some monitoring on it really quick while things are running in the backfield. I'll hit a few sets, come back in, check it out, hit a few more sets. So that's how I work out. And then I do things all throughout the day like that, do stuff like this all throughout the night, go back to sleep at about 2:30 a.m., get back up and do it all over again. So, but it's keeping, it's difficult to have your eggs in a lot of different baskets. And I do the exact same thing. There are things that are just not, I'm just not able to commit my time to them. And, you know, like, I guess you'd say like the culture element that people get into, like the Hollywood stuff, fame, celebrities, all that kind of stuff. I despise it. Don't have time for it. Don't want anything to do with it. People bring up celebrity names. I have no idea who they are. You know, all this stuff like that. But, I mean, obviously you come across things whether you want to or not. And being in our scape with politics, you're still going to see ads and little articles pop up that have to do with things. I mean, I can go trying to look at a place like Breitbart.
Almost everything I've learned about a celebrity, I've learned about them against my will. Absolutely.
Exactly. Absolutely, yeah. Brother. And I mean, it's, you know, you go to Breitbart or the New York Post or anything that's kind of a, you know, a central or not totally left-leaning outlet, you still see those articles down, you know, a couple down the chain of such and such a celebrity OD'd or somebody was in a domestic dispute with their, you know, their lover or whatever else. So you see the names like the Kardashians.
Dancing naked with knives again.
But yeah, you see all of those names of people that we should truly despise because of their lack of morality, like the Kardashians and all the rest of them out there that are unfortunately a lot of the people who influence our upcoming generations. And that's one of the terrible things. And I, you know, we've talked about this, and sometimes it feels like you're beating a dead horse, but truly it's one of the biggest topics as three fathers right here. I think that's important overall is that male responsibility in a home and the fact that there is such a huge detriment to children who grow up without some form of a male role model, whether it be their dad, a stepdad, or just, you know, somebody who is in that kind of a, you know, that kind of a pocket in their life.
Well, it's like that study
it can be a difficult thing.
Sorry.
Go ahead, brother.
No, I was saying, it's just like that study they did on the success of children that came out of a dual parent home and then the success of children entering life coming out of a single mother home, and that the percentage of success, I guess, however they're measuring this metric for children and how they became as adults, the success of children leaving a single parent home that was a single father home were closest to a dual parent home than they were for a child leaving a single mother home, right? There's something to be said for that, you know, because your father really is that first taste of discipline that you get. It's the one, it is the parent most often who, you know, is the first person to check you when you do something wrong, right? What does your mom say? Wait till your father gets home, right? That's like the real like butthole pucker moment in the afternoon when you get home from school and you're being a shatheed, right? Like that's, it's coming later, you know, it's like, that's where that sort of respect for boundaries, that sort of respect for, you know, authoritarian roles that, you know, are necessary in a hierarchical structure like we have in our lives, right? That's where all of that comes from. So it's no wonder when you look at like all of these kids that come out of single mother homes, and I'm not knocking moms, I'm just saying, right, like that fear and that respect doesn't exist. I mean, like, I'll put it this way, dude, like my wife and I are talking about this. We've talked about this before, is that like little boys tend to be much more disrespectful to their moms than they are to their dad. And I think that is probably just some sort of like natural behavior that happens, and that it, you know, I have to correct that behavior because I'm showing him that it's okay, not okay, or okay, whatever it is that's going on, that behavior, the way you're talking to, you know, them or whatever, that's where that comes from. And all of that is just the blueprint for engagement with everybody as an adult. So it's no wonder, right, that those statistics are closer, and just how important fathers are and that tough love that you give, right? and the way that you teach them to, you know, respect people's boundaries and take care of things, and then understanding too that, you know, self-reliance is really one of the most important virtues that you can harness in your life. I mean, you're a great example of that. Like everything you have, right? Like you made your gym at home, everything you do about work, you invited into your life and you created a career out of these things to, and also maintain the position that you need to maintain as a husband, a father, a role model, somebody that also needs to take care of himself and put some of the needs that you have first, right? So you did that with you know, that idea in mind of self-reliance and no one is going to do it for you. And that's the sort of thing that, like, you especially should be teaching your young sons, is that not everybody's going to do these things for you. It's okay to invite struggle and watch them overcome those struggles, because that's exactly how people are going to learn. And just sort of, it kind of ties into a thought I was having earlier listening to you, George, about, it's so funny in the society we have, there's nothing that sort of binds everybody together, which is why everybody's so scattered to the wind and we just can't seem to find common ground anymore. But when you consider just how much of a smaller unit that we all used to come from, these tribes, these, you know, and developed into nations and all these things, that like the roles we all have are more evident, right? Not just the roles we play in society, but the roles you play in, you know, husband and wife or son or leader or whatever, or daughter, all these things, like they have points of purposes. And, you know, finding what you're interested in, right, is probably where you're going to travel to or move toward, rather, in that smaller knit community. And it's going to be more evident, right, what you care about more. I care more about, I don't know, picking berries and going over here. I care more about hunting. I care more about making things, you know, with my hands that other people can use. And this sort of like that natural gravity pulls you that way. But it's so much harder to take like that small scale idea of what you're talking about, of community, finding what you care enough about to put enough energy into to get done, and then superimposing this concept of small community onto a nation is incredibly difficult to do, because it's, you know, there's so many different things to take your time away from you. There's so many different things to care about. It's almost just inundating to think about the things you can care about. But like at the end of the day, if we were to go back to something like that, all of these roles we have, all of these things that we care about, right, they are what hold, they're the ties that bind. There's a shared struggle involved, and that shared struggle is more recognizable when you're talking about 10, 12, 20, 50 people versus an entire city of a million people. You know, it's not so evident anymore. So like having those conversations, to your point, George, it will help them, you know, somebody else recognize what I care about or what I don't care about. And maybe that's kind of just that way. It takes more effort, I think, to get those things done versus when you're living in a smaller community, you can just see them happen and it just becomes, you know, the way that community functions. It's just kind of funny, you know, everything ties back to that, and just kind of the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree. I mean, I think the biggest thing too is like when we talk about our commitments to things, I think the biggest thing, what it comes down to, is at the end of the day, there is a very small group of individuals within all of our lives that we do not want to let down.
Yeah.
And I genuinely do care about the welfare of every single one of my neighbors, every single American, and people in the world as a whole. I absolutely do. Like, I want the best for everyone. I want everyone to live a good life. But you have to recognize that at a certain point, if you put too much attention on something else, something, like, on the flip side, another thing is going to suffer. And so you have to set your priorities in order. You know, it's like, what's the saying goes, is the cobbler's kids are always barefoot. And
I've never heard that, but I like that.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you have to prioritize that, you have your family first, then you have your extended family, and then you have your close knit group of friends. You know, maybe it's your church, you know, or your neighbors or whatnot. But that circle gets bigger and bigger. And as it gets bigger and bigger, if you start putting your, you know, putting yourself in too many of those circles and too far out, you're spread too thin and other aspects will suffer.
Very true.
And so, you know, when we look at, when you were saying, TJ, about like, you know, having the roles and as a father and everything, I think that, you know, we hear so much about toxic masculinity these days, and I would agree that there is a lot of toxic masculinity. I know, like, a lot of people in conservatives say, like, you know, it's not a thing or whatnot. I would argue that there is way too much. And the reason is because what so many people have been told is what the masculine way of being is not actually what it's supposed to be. I mean, I remember in college. What would you define it as? You know, I remember as in college, I thought I was a whole macho guy. You know, I was in a frat, I was partying, having fun, you know, oh, look how much I can lift, or look how much I can drink. And like, that was the guy's guy, quote unquote, you know? But that's not what a masculine man is. That's not the type of man I want to set an example for as my, you know, for my son. So I would argue that we do have toxic masculinity. And what we need to do is show the proper form of what is a good example of being a masculine man in society. And that's caring about those closest to you and then working out from that circle and having responsibility. You know, TJ, you're saying you're up, you know, at the break of dawn and taking care of those who you love. That's the example we should set. That's a masculine example. Yeah. And so I think that if we had more true men acting in a responsible role, our society would benefit immensely. And so, you know, yes, there are obviously issues when the man is not present in a family and there's no father figure at all. But there's also the problem, too, of people who are fathers and they don't set a good example. Or you know, they're distant and they're not being, you know, a father, and they're not really being present. So their sons and daughters look elsewhere for examples. You know, you hear about like the Brandon, who's the Tate or something.
Andrew Tate.
Yeah. You know, I the amount of times I've heard people say, like, you know, younger kids in college or so say, like, oh yeah, that he's a cool guy. I'm like, I was curious. And I looked up some of his stuff. I'm like, no. You know who the cool guy is? Is the guy you've never heard about, who lives out in Texas, wakes up at the break of dawn, and takes care of his family. His name's TJ, and you're never going to know him.
Yeah.
That's the example you should be looking at, you know? It's the guys who you never hear about, who just live their life and take care of their family. And if we had more examples of that, but unfortunately those guys, you know, don't get the viral clips. They don't have, you know, the millions of followers, because it's not catchy. It's not punchy. It's not what society is, like, told us we should value.
I think that's a good point to sort of square that circle on what, like, toxic masculinity, like, really is, right? It's not these things the left says. It's not, you know, traditional values. It's not being a family man. It's not, you know, taking care of your family. Like, that's the way the left defines toxic masculinity. Like, the way I would view it is, like, somebody like Andrew Tate, or, like, if you remember back in the day when Dan Bilzerian wasn't just being a full total anti-Semite retard online, but he was just posting all these other videos and pictures of him with all these chicks on these big boats and stuff like that. Like, that that was like the idea of, like, masculinity. So, like, that version of, like, a man, I would say, is like the wrong projection, to your point. Sort of the same sort of person that, you know, Andrew Tate is, I guess, you know, big, you know, big expensive cars, lots of money, cigars. I mean, I love cigars and whiskey too, but, like, that's not all there is to life, right? It's not all these, just like, it's almost like, if you can take everything that's emblematic of what a magazine would tell you to be that a man is like, that's the version of, like, toxic masculinity you're talking about. When reality, right, you know, it's the little guy, and like, we're not TJ, not calling you short, bro. You know, you are kind of short like me, you know, but you get what I'm trying to say. And you know, going back to, like, this whole, like, joint struggle thing, I almost think it's so hard to even recognize that joint struggle, because we're also inundated with it every single day. There's almost too much struggle to figure out what to care enough about, right? So, like, to your point again, finding what you do care about. But also, it's like that, it's like the Jordan Peterson quote about, like, trying to change the world. Well, maybe start with cleaning your room, right? Start small. That little circle you draw around yourself, if you can fix the problems in that small circle, then you can draw a bigger one and fix the problems in that circle, right? There's nothing wrong with that. Like, begin at the beginning, to keep using analogies here, right? But begin at the beginning and do what you can, and take care of these things in your life. And if everybody did that, you know, like, I'd ideologically, like it should come together, you know, going back to the whole community thing, community policing, community gardens, like the people that have to teach each other to grow food, find out who's got the ham radio in your neighborhood, find out who's really good at shooting. Like that's your militia. That's your well-regulated militia. Figure out in your neighbors how, you know, how we're going to get through this. If something happens, you know, where are we going to go? Who can do this? Who's got a boat? Who's got whatever, you know, all of these things is like you're solving. If you feel overwhelmed with the large problems we're all hit with in the news every day at the national level or the global level, we'll start solving the problems in your own neighborhood. And you know, and this is never going to happen. But like if everybody did that and fixing these small problems instead of othering the solution and saying, well, that's somebody else's job, then, you know, if you can sit there and say, well, that's somebody's job, but you don't know who and you're bitching about it, right? Well, that's your job. Like, you can do that. Or if you don't know how to do that, you can help find a way to figure out how to get it done or help facilitate a way to get that done. Complaining isn't an actual solution, you know? Exactly. So it's just, that's what this is. You know, if you feel overwhelmed by the struggle going on around the world or the problems going on around the world, find out what problems that your neighbor is also going through, because it's very likely that you're also dealing with those same problems. And then that's the sort of way you develop that small enough community to where you're creating that joint struggle or recognizing that joint struggle again that is existing, and it's the ties that bind with everybody. That's, you know, the last time that anybody can think of a struggle as big or a problem as big as, you know, that can combine the entire nation was 9/11, right? And how many of those things are going to happen? Hopefully never, knock on wood, that nothing like that ever happens again. But it did. It happened. And so many people, you know, the American flags were everywhere. You know, find joint struggle another way. Figure out what problems everybody in your neighborhood or your community is dealing with, and recognize that joint struggle. And you'll find, I think, that everybody can get together and set those differences aside, like you said, George, and work toward that common goal.
I think, too, you know, you brought up kind of, the ham radio, the boat, the skill sets of, you know, farming and stuff like that. And, you know, I think a huge thing, especially for me living in Chicago, it sounds cool when people say that stuff. But then I start realizing, like, I live in a 3-bedroom house in, you know, downtown Chicago. You know, I don't have the opportunity or the resources for certain things like that. Yeah. So I think one of the things people have to realize is, recognize where you are and work from there. So for me,
and
start with the simplest step. So when my wife and I, when we moved into our neighborhood and bought the house, one of the first ways that I was able to kind of just start helping my community and kind of get involved was the first snowstorm that hit. I got out the snowblower and I just snowblowed the block and shoveled everyone's front steps. I woke up in the morning. I was like 6 a.m. I noticed. And I was like, I'll just do this. Why not? A week later or so, one of the neighbors saw and was like, hey, was that you out there? I was like, yeah. You know, happy to help. We'd been living in the house for about 6 months. I still hadn't met the neighbor. He lives like 3 houses down. Mm-hmm. And so just started in conversation then. So it's just a little things like that is, regardless of where you live, find a way to help. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, don't even do it as looking as a way to meet your neighbors necessarily. Just look out for ways that you can help your neighbors, even if you don't know them yet.
That's true.
Now what we do is, one way for us to really get to know the neighbors was during Christmas, bought a box of Fannie Mae chocolates, put a Christmas card on it. We went up and down the block and dropped it off at each house. Just saying, hey, we moved into the neighborhood in the summer. Haven't met you guys. Just wanted to drop off a little box of chocolates and a Christmas card. You know, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. Just kind of foot in the door, no pun intended.
Sure.
You know, and then from there, every spring for Memorial Day, we have a barbecue and we just print out a little piece of paper, put it in their mailbox. If they show up, great. If they don't, no worries. But it's having that sense of community and showing people that you are wanted, that we do want to have a relationship with you. And so whether you're living out in the middle of Texas or in a big city, are the routes going to look different? Of course, but it's still doable. It's still the same premise.
It's a matter of the effort, I think, brother.
Yeah, that's still exactly the effort.
Right. And that was one of the things I was thinking about is, if you look at the contrast, and I truly believe in my heart this is by design, a couple of different things as we were talking about the toxic masculinity, of course. That image of Andrew Tate, you'll hear a lot of people, particularly on the left, of, you know, progressive far left side, complaining about him. But I find that that is done, in my opinion, I think it's theatric, because most of those people also hold the globalist agenda. They're the people who have been trying to destroy the nuclear family. They're the people who have been trying to dissolve communities. They're the people who have been trying to deter people from faith in God. And he is just like a beta male, or, you know, the soy boy, or the metrosexual. He is the opposite extreme of that. He also is somebody who constantly supports being promiscuous. He's somebody who basically glamorizes that bachelor lifestyle. Do for yourself, get the nice cars, be successful in your career. No matter who you have to screw over, no matter whose head you have to step on, it still feeds their cause. It's not helping build communities. It's not helping generate that element that made our country so great in the first place, with people helping each other, having a sense of morality, having a good foundation, caring about families, caring about each other's families. That is not in his mindset, and it's not in the mindset of the beta males either. And that's exactly what they're looking for, is that division, that separation, that reliance upon government, that, rather than the reliance upon God and the commitment to your family. And in that, you'll see that contrast between places like where I live and what I consider to be that metroplex mentality. If you look at people per se, let's say living in Manhattan, they're in the subways every day. They don't look each other in the eye. They don't say hello to each other. Mm-hmm. And people from, you know, tourists wave or say hello to someone, they look at them like they're out of their minds. And it is that whole, they've, again, I believe, been kind of programmed in that sense to be trapped in their box, trapped in that little condo they live in. They don't want anything to do with their neighbors. They don't want to be bothered with anyone. Because of the element of how overwhelming everything has become, it's an anxiety issue all the time. They don't know if they're dealing with somebody who's going to be, you know, a murderer, serial rapist, drug dealer, what kind of stuff they're going to get involved in. So everybody wants to kind of take the edge of their coat, pull it up, walk down the sidewalk, get on the subway, get their way to work, and they do the same thing on the way back home. Try to have as little interaction as possible, and it creates that division. And, you know, that's a difficult thing. But as you said, George, you can break those boundaries by trying to be a good person and just kind of laying those little goose eggs, putting out some Christmas cards or whatever, and hoping that somebody feels a little light inside and decides they want to respond. And you can build a system of networks in some of those types of communities. And there are some great success stories of people who decided to do so in some areas where they were kind of more negatively viewed neighborhoods, high crime neighborhoods, where they, again, are living in the concrete jungle, essentially, and started trying to network with people, finding out who their neighbors were, finding out people who had like ideas and who wanted to help the community. And they kind of built their own, you know, community patrol, so to speak, which is kind of a neat thing. And it's like that video that we'd watched not too long ago here, Brandon, as well, of all those fathers who realized that the schools weren't doing anything about the violence.
The one that
the lack
YouTube
of attendance.
Didn't like and
exactly.
Banned the video for. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a group of dads, you know, school that had some violence issues, had major attendance issues, a lot of kids ditching class, ditching school altogether. And they decided to group together, some of them patrol around the community, see if the kids weren't going to school. And others were right there in the halls of the school, making sure kids were going to class and kind of building up some morale. And the way they looked at it is a lot of those children were in homes with no dads. So they thought, who were the best group of people to solve this problem, since the schools dads. Aren't solving it, the community wasn't solving it. It was a group of dads who decided they were going to be dads to all the kids instead of just to their own.
Do you remember that video back influence. In the, that video back in the day? I don't remember if it was on, like, it could have been like on Maury or Jerry Springer or something like that, but they brought all those kids on the show, and they had some dude, if I think he was like an ex drill sergeant, and he's yelling at this kid, and he's like, "Do you want me to be your daddy?" And he's like, "Yes." And he starts crying. He's like, "Why do you want me to be your daddy?" He's like, "Because I don't have a daddy." Just totally, like, dude, every time I see that video pop up, like, I watch it. You know, it still kicks me in the nuts, like, seeing that, because it is. It sucks, dude, seeing some kid like that. You know, he's getting chewed out like all these other kids, and he's not afraid. He's sad, you know?
Yeah.
That's what he's feeling. The emotion he's feeling is sad, you know?
Yeah.
And it just hits that guy right in the gut, too, because you can see his entire demeanor changes when he hears that kid say that, you know, and is all over and, like, took him to the back of the studio or whatever. But it is, dude, it's so important, like, to have a dad in your life, a male role model, you know, somebody, especially for men, like I'm just talking about like men now, you know, like it's so important to have. I think that's also why it's so important for guys to have friends that hold them accountable. So important to have, even at, you know, your peers, right? Like all of us, like relatively, you know, the same age. I know TJ, you remember what the War of 1812 was like, but you know, it's relatively the same age, you know, like we understand, you know, we're all fathers. We're going through these struggles the same time, even though our kids are all, you know, different ages. My daughter is roughly close to some of the ages of your kids, you know, but that's what this is. You need a community, whether it's the neighbor you're snow plowing or snow shoveling for or snow blowing for, right? Or, you know, it's the guy you figure out that, you know, hey, I can help him with this and he can help me with that. And we're, you know, finding these problems. It is. It's just like you have to. We're that pack of human beings that needs a community, and we need real people to check us, to tell us when we're fucking up, you know, to tell us what's good and what's not good, you know, and somebody to bounce these ideas off of and just sort of, you know, you are the company you keep. Right. And so let it be good company.
Yeah, and like the last thing I'll say on that, kind of this, like to round off this discussion on this topic is what I started this almost a year ago now, and I call them wood table discussions. Mm-hmm. And once a month, I send out a actual letter by snail mail with a time, a date, and a location, and a summary of what we're going to have for dinner. And I send it out to about 6 to 8 of my buddies. And once a month we meet, and it started with just me hosting it, and it's now evolved where every month someone else hosts it. And the idea behind it is that for sure, once a month, you're going to be able to sit down with like-minded guys. We put our phones down in another room so there's no distractions. We sit down at a table, have dinner, have a drink or two, and we just talk. And sometimes it's really serious conversations. It's a no questions asked and fight club rules of like what's talked about here stays here. Mm-hmm. So some months the dinner will be pretty serious. You know, guys will be talking about relationship, you know, looking for relationship advice, business advice, really job advice, stuff like that, father advice. Yep. And we answer it as best we can. Other months it's just we shoot the shit and have a good time. But it's really built this awesome community between about, you know, eight or so guys where once a month we know we're going to meet and we can reach out to each other. And no matter what, we can send a text and say, hey, I'm struggling with something. Could you help me out? Do you have any advice on this? So it's built that sense of community. And it really started because I realized I had a good group of friends, but not all of them were friends with each other. So I said, hey, why am I friends with these people? Because they all have similar values. And so I said, hey, they should all know each other. And now they're all close friends. So my advice for anyone who's struggling with trying to start that sense of community is if you have a group of people who they may not be all friends, invite them over for dinner. Just have a dinner with, you know, a couple of guys, sit down, talk, start those friendships, start those relationships, network in that sense, because you never know where it's going to go.
Yeah. I love that you said that those conversations are always different, because I think that it just supports your earlier thesis on not wasting your energy. You know, you're putting your energy toward whatever, however those conversations organically happen. It's just whatever you guys needed at that point, you know, and it just goes back to not wasting your time on crap you don't have any desire to participate in, and not wasting your time on things that you're not going to care about, you know? So I think that's a really good message. And it's not even like a message you hear that often, you know, don't waste your own time. Basically that's an important one, but, I would be curious to hear about your ideas on how the first 3 months of the Trump presidency is going.
Mixed. You know, I think there's some things that I've got pretty excited about and glad to see. But at the same time, you know, I look at Trump like any other president, any other politician. You know, there's going to be things where I agree with him on, and there's going to be things where I disagree with him on. You know, I know that there are people on the far left who think he's the worst person ever. You know, and then there's people on the left who think he's, you know, the greatest. or the, yeah, on the right, there's people who think he's the greatest. So, you know, you have the extremes on both ends. For me, I'm kind of in the middle. If he does something that is really good, I'll say, hey, that's awesome. So, you know, for me personally, when I saw RFK get nominated, and now that he's in, I was like, that's awesome. I'm really glad to see he upheld his promises there. But I'm also not, you know, afraid or against criticizing him. So, you know, I think it's too early to tell. You know, there's one thing everyone can agree on is that he says a lot. He says a lot of stuff, for better and for worse. So, you know, we can't take everything. We got to take it all with a grain of salt. We'll see how things play out. But yeah, I'd say, you know, I'm pretty mixed on it. I also, you know me, I don't get too invested in the grand scheme things. You know, I really, like we've talked about, I really try to focus on my community, my life, my family, my friends. And so are there certain things that I could get worked up about or I could get really excited about? Absolutely. But how much does that truly affect my day-to-day life? And so, you know, it's easy to get on Facebook, Twitter, or X, or, you know, whatever, and start commenting and get into an argument or start, you know, praising and agreeing with people and getting in an echo chamber. But at the end of the day, that doesn't end it in a productive, you know, it's not a productive result. So I kind of just, I'm sitting back seeing. I think there is some really good stuff that he's been doing, you know, with the border patrol or and the border control aspect. I think that's awesome. You know, I'm really glad to see he's taking, you know, right away, you know, pedal to the metal.
Happened immediately.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. You know, and there's other things where, you know, with, you know, there's the debate with the tariffs. I don't know enough about it, you know, the economy to say if that's a good or bad thing. So I'm just kind of sitting back and saying it might work out. It might help, but yeah, I don't know. It could fall apart and, you know, hurt.
There's good examples. So, like, actually, it's so funny you say that because I had a conversation yesterday with a coworker about tariffs. And I mean, I live in California. You guys know that if you've been listening to the podcast, you know, for a long time. So most everybody I meet is liberal for the most part, you know? And so I avoid on purpose political conversations with people because I'm not from California and I'm not a liberal. Right. So, but I do have a coworker who is a lot more open-minded and will ask me questions about what I think, you know, knowing, and I think it's also should be said that, you know, they all know I'm ex-military. So there's like an assumption too on that part that my leanings are going to be more to the right than anything anyway. So they always want to know my opinion on things. And so we were having a conversation and she said, you know, historically tariffs have never worked. So I was just like, well, I'll give you a really, really good example of a time that they did work. So after World War II, and we dropped the sun on Japan twice, the American government let Japan tariff the United States on purpose and basically help rebuild their entire economy, right? And that was done by tariffs. And now you could say, okay, well, that was willingly, like the United States did that on purpose and you know, and implemented tariffs on goods so that, you know, we could basically repay the Japanese back for generations of problems because of the nuclear bombs. Well, like, let me give you another example of tariffs working. In 1816, after the War of 1812 was over, James Madison and Henry Clay imposed tariffs on the British government and tried to stop them from bringing in cheap goods into the United States, which was, you know, making it harder for American industry to flourish and our very young country after fighting, you know, for independence for the second time from the British Empire, which sounds really familiar when you look at the way that we import everything from China, these cheap goods, and it you know, makes it harder for smaller mom and pop American businesses to do business because, you know, they have to make things and sell things and they have to sell them more expensive than the cheap crap you can buy wherever that's just imported, right? And because of that 1816 tariff, it helped keep British goods, cheap British goods, out of the young United States, right? So, like, that, I think, is a very relevant example, especially when you look at the way that we're doing business with the Chinese and just how much of our own personal industry that we've lent out to the world and not making things here anymore. And I think at the end of the day, when you look at what happened with the collapse of the British Empire, to keep on that theme, you know, they went from making so much, the revolution of industry happened, you know, in England. That's where, you know, the financial capital of the world when the British Empire was the predominant empire was in London, you know, all of this industry, the banking, all of that happened and went through the UK, and they shifted from, you know, being that person or being that country that was innovating and industrializing, you know, and being the financial center of the world to just managing wealth and failing to upkeep all of the colonial assets that they had and these things. You know, it starts to sound very familiar. The United States manages a lot of assets and wealth, doesn't make as much stuff as it used to, right? It's having problems with places that we've overextended ourselves, you know. So the idea of bringing, you know, of suffering now for the reward later, and bringing industry back to the United States, and watching the other part of that conversation we had was like, oh well, look at the stock market today, you know, it's a bear market. It's like, cool, but on January 20th versus today, the stock market is still up 1700 points from where it was before, and it's down 7% today. And it's so just because it's red right now doesn't mean everything is ruined, you know. And so it's just like, let's have a little perspective here. Let's learn some lessons from the past. And I can point to you one example where a tariff worked in a very similar fashion to the problems we have today of underproducing and you know, buying too much cheap goods, you know. So like, it, they do work, you know, and they have worked in the past. Just to, I did a lot of reading on these things the last couple of days because I had a genuine interest, like what you just said, George, about like not knowing. Like, economics is a very tough subject, you know, and most people, I think, especially on the right, thought that like, oh, we're going to tariff Canada for X reason or China for X reason. It just means like, well, now they owe us more money for goods. Well, like, that's not how that works, you know. Like, there, no. This is a different, it's, you have to understand how that works. But anyway, it's just, we're sure. learning a lot, you know, and we're understanding how Always. These things work, you know. And the steel industry did really well with tariffs when Trump was president last time. It really did. It brought a lot of that industry back and put a lot of Americans to work in the steel industry. So there's another example, just saying.
Absolutely. We have to be willing to get our hands dirty again, and that's one of the biggest things is everybody's fear is how much the price of all of these imported goods is going to go up. Well, maybe we shouldn't be relying on imported goods, kind of the bottom line. And tariffs, just like you said, brother, not only have worked domestically on a handful of occasions, but they have worked outside of our country on tons of occasions, including most of the countries that are robbing us blind in that exact same sense. Mm-hmm. We are tariffed to death by other nations, and people do not realize it, in the hundreds of percent quite often. So people are balking at the thought of a 25% increase of tariffs on Canada or Mexico when we're getting hit for 280% by some other countries for auto imports.
Dude, Canada has been tariffing us forever, and that's the point. We let them, though, and that's Trump's point about, you know, more fair business practices between you know, countries. And I just think it's funny. I made a reel about it and put it on Instagram. We've talked about it on the podcast too. TJ remembers listening to all these Europeans cry about crap. It's like, well, you have absolutely no problem taking our money for defense spending, and you can get together a bunch of floats real fast and have an anti-Trump parade, you know, or the French women just seem to think that their boobs being out and marching around with an EU flag painted on their chest or a swastika painting there is somehow, you know, an efficient form of protest. But, you know, you have no problem taking America's money when it comes to all of your defense, you know. But I get, whatever, dude, that's free speech. Go complain about it, I suppose.
There you go. That's exactly right. But no, you're exactly right there, brother. And that's what I look at, is the nations that are doing that and they're getting a lot of their money through those tariffs are not taxing their people anywhere near as much. And I think that is, it's a dual faceted tool in my eyes. I think Donald Trump is using it as a negotiating point, which actually has been working. And some of the countries try to balk back a little bit, but they always end up regressing. Mm-hmm. And they decide to negotiate and try to do something better in the end. It happened right off the bat the first time with Claudia Sheinbaum and with, you know, Justin the Turd. You know, they both acted as if they were going to stand against Trump. And within a day to two, or, you know, a day or two, they shrunk back. They went ahead. They put the extra troops on the border. They started cutting down the amount of people who were illegally crossing from both sides. The reason he decided to put the imposition back out is because the fentanyl was still flowing into the country at almost the same rate, even though the illegal immigrants were not. So they were still managing to get the drugs over. They just weren't staying here. Yeah. So we weren't having the problem with the bodies coming over the border and trying to come into the country and flood it. But we were still having the chemicals come in. And that's why he said, okay, you know, you're not doing anything about the drug enforcement side still. So we're going to go ahead. We're going to let these tariffs roll until you fix it.
Well, you make me think of a really interesting point, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this, George. Is like when you talk about, okay, we can stop the flow of fentanyl coming into the country. You know, we had this conversation sort of with Katarina when we had her on the first time, TJ, you'll remember. You know, well, okay, you can try and stop the flow of drugs coming in, but how do you stop the appetite for them? You know, and the broader question it was getting at is like, how do you legislate morality?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the this will tie up pretty much everything we've talked about, so it'll be a good way to round off the whole conversation. Is there's a quote from C.S. Lewis.
We were just talking about the Screwtapes last night.
I might be butchering it, but more or less the quote goes, "You can't make good men by law, mm-hmm. and or you can't make just men by law, and unjust men don't make good law." And so I think the problem with society nowadays is we look at the government, we look at legislation as a way to solve our problems, every problem. Yeah. When the reality is that the only way to really solve the root cause of any problem is the morality of society. So, like to your point, you know, they stopped the flow of one aspect of the, you know, the actual people, but the drugs were still coming. Yeah. So they tried to find a solution to fix it, but it didn't, right? And you can apply that mentality with pretty much any issue we have. You pass a law, you start implementing one aspect of the law, but the problem still stands. They find it.
You create a parallel economy where people are going to find it anyway.
Right.
That's why gun laws don't work.
Right. And so I think that at the end of the day, it kind of circles back to the sense of community. You have to look at yourself, look at your neighbors, and say, what can I do to improve the lives most immediate to me? And then that will have a ripple effect, or a domino effect, however, whatever term you want to use. And I truly believe that the only way we can solve these pressing issues is by changing ourselves. Mm-hmm. Laws are great when we have good people in office and passing just laws, mm-hmm. but they're just that. They are kind of like a stoplight, right? A stoplight, most people will stop at, and they will obey the rules of the road. But that light isn't stopping anyone from running it.
Right.
And so that's the way I kind of see laws. In the simplest way to break down a law is a stoplight. It'll stop most people and convince most people, but there's no actually weight behind it. Unless there's a cop there and then you get pulled over, you know, and there's repercussions. And that's how laws are. If you break a law and you figure out a way to get away with it, most people will just keep doing it if they don't have a moral compass. So
it's governance by consensus is what it is.
Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of, I would say, like the best way of summing up everything we've talked about is finding your own moral compass and then finding people who share a similar value and, you know, build from there. And it's a long road ahead, but that's the only way I see lasting, impactful change that our kids, our grandkids and so forth will thank us for.
And if I could add one thing on top of that is teach your kids to have difficult conversations. None of this, we don't talk about religion or politics, like teach them how to have conversations about difficult things. I think a lot of the problems we have today are because people have never had or taught to have difficult conversations with one another. It's okay to navigate difficult things like religion and politics. That whole conversation I was just talking about with my coworker, she sat there and listened to me tell her about like previous examples of tariffs, sat there and explained to her some of the things, you know, from history, and she listened and we had a conversation, you know, and I don't know if I changed her heart or changed her mind, you know, but like it was a difficult conversation. I was uneasy at first to have it because it's like, oh shit, here I am at work having a conversation about politics, you know what I mean? Like, but it was fine, you know, and it's just, I think that's it. That's what I would add on to that is teach your children to have difficult conversations respectfully with people. And I think you'll find that a lot more things improve too, doing something like that.
Absolutely. I think it's a help to break through complacency because we have become a society of complacency and indifference.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of people would rather just put themselves, like I said, in their cube and ignore everything that's going on around them. Just assume that as long as they have what they need and they're doing what they want to do, mm-hmm. everything else is just going to be okay. It's going to work out on its own. They live passively, and they don't actually live actively as citizens of the country they live in. And that's not just here. There's lots of other nations that are failing that way as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about that all the time, that citizenship isn't passive, and that's the truth.
Correct.
We have to have a much more active part in everything that goes on. And even if that's just at the small communal level of understanding our neighbors, hearing out their conversations, finding out we all do have, you know, similar likes and interests and therefore have similar wants for our future, for the future of our families, our children, grandchildren, or for people who don't have kids, they still quite often are friends with their neighbors or whatever, and they care about what's going to happen to their neighbors' kids.
Yeah, dude.
When you have those particular thoughts and ideas and you know your politicians at the grassroots level, you're able to speak to them and make sure that those ideas make their way all the way up the chain to D.C. so that the things that people actually want, since we are supposed to be governing ourselves here, are actually being done rather than other people out there in faraway Washington, D.C. just doing whatever they want based on, you know, whoever's contributing mm-hmm. the most money.
Yeah. But George, I know you don't have a big presence on social media. Your book sort of has its own page, although it's pretty small. Where can people, I mean, are you going to be more, start being more present on that page as a,
yeah,
as a focal
yeah.
point for your ideas? Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say, the book has a page on Instagram. It's, Hill Worth Dying On. And then I also have a recently made a page on, X.
Okay.
It's just called, I believe the tag is, or the at is at Worth Dying On.
Follow that right now.
I'm sure if you find at a Hill Worth Dying On, search that, you can find it too. Other than that, that's kind of my go-to.
Boom.
Obviously, you know, you guys can appreciate my personal Instagram and social media. It's all private, so mm-hmm. No point putting, I'm not trying to be Insta-famous on there. But yeah, Hill Worth Dying On is on X and also on Instagram.
Gotcha. Yeah.
No, I love the thing you put on here. It says, doing my best to channel a modern Thomas Paine. I love Thomas Paine, by the way. Yeah, such Thomas an Paine interesting awesome. Person. Just go and if you really want to learn something obscure about Thomas Paine, go and learn about his funeral.
Six
Just leave
people.
That with. Yeah, exactly. Just leave that with you guys listening. If you want to learn something very obscure about somebody who's a founding father and rather controversial founding father, if you really dig into who he is, go Google what his funeral. It's pretty interesting to learn about it. But George, thank you so much for coming on again.
No, thank you. And yeah, we'll be on next time I'm on, it'll be sooner than the gap of last time.
Dude,
and we can dive into Thomas Paine. We can do a nice deep
like
dive
that.
Of that.
That's a good way to Heck do yeah. that. If we do that, we got to invite Aaron on, Aaron Love, because he also loves Thomas Paine. And I know you like Aaron. Aaron's a good freaking dude. And hopefully we'll have Chris back with us too as well. So, but thanks again for coming on, man. We can't let 60 episodes go by without having you on again, even though we did get you as a sit-in co-host for that one episode. It's fun to have these bro talks, dude, and sit here and have these sorts of conversations. It's totally different than sitting with a guest and having somebody on, you know. It's much better, I think, just talking to you and hearing your voice and all of these things. So I appreciate you coming back on. Appreciate all of you guys for listening. Please check out the sponsors in the show notes. We got Alp now. I don't know. I know RFK is on that, the Alp slopes, but if you didn't know, George... We now got that. We got that sponsorship going on, bro. So, yeah, if you're, I know you're still over there in Zimbabwe, but maybe we can coax you onto the Alp slopes with us. So, yeah, but no, you guys go find those codes in the show notes. We got Alp, like I just said. We got Killcliff Energy, which I'm sitting here drinking right now. The Joe Rogan Flamin' Joe episode, jalapeno pineapple is the bomb. I love that. Protect products. We got the light sleeper system, which is great. Chris uses it all the time. It's like a whoopee sleeping bag, basically. It's pretty sick.
He snuggles it on the floor while his wife sleeps in the bed, man. It's a little creepy.
Well, you know, when you're in trouble all the time, I guess, you know, you kind of have to do those things. Exactly. Yeah, he was right. It's the very stoic thing to do. I'm going to do the Marcus Aurelius thing and the Seneca thing and sleep on the floor just to feel the struggle, right? No, and then go check out Redefine Violence, of course. And yeah, so thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll catch you guys on another episode.